Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. It's another issue of another episode of Rebooting the News with me and Jay Rosen. Jay?
Hi, Dave.
Hey, Jay. How you doing, man?
Welcome to Rebooting the News number 39. We're 30. Back on schedule.
39, just in time for our midlife crisis, I guess.
I'm not having a midlife crisis.
Well,
my daughter
at 39 is usually when people seem to have them.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I'm well past that.
Yeah, me too. Do you mind, if you don't mind my asking, how old are you, Jay?
I'm 53.
53, so I'm older
yeah.
than you.
Yeah.
By a whole year. So, what should we
So, let's get right to our show, because people are anxious to hear what we think. And
so we think.
Actually, we're anxious to hear what we think.
I think that could be said, probably.
Yeah. So let's start off with the big event in the tech and media worlds last week, which was the announcement of Apple's iPad. And
right.
at the time it was being built up, I didn't have all that much to say, but I have a little bit of insight into it now. But I wanted to start with you and ask you, now that the announcement has come and some of the first reactions are in and some of the discussion has started, what's your view of this and its ability to change the game at all?
Oh, it changes the game. It does. If you recall, in the last episode, I put my stake in the ground and said, you know, here's my speculation based on no information whatsoever. And the only thing I got right was that they would remove ports. And they sure as hell did that.
Yeah.
The thing has absolutely nothing beyond what the iPhone has. It's a big iPhone, basically. That's all really you can say about it from a product standpoint. That's really all we know. It doesn't, you know, I had extrapolated that so much time had passed between the initial rollout of the iPhone, which was like 3 years ago, that, you know, they probably had some stuff in the labs at that, even at the time of the iPhone rollout, that wasn't ready. And 3 years surely is enough time to get some, you know, the next generation of this stuff ready. But we sure didn't see the next generation here. There was no new, I mean, in this world, gestures is what matters. You know, it's like this is a new user interface for computing. And so it's like instead of having a mouse and, you know, and a keyboard and arrow keys and whatever else, you know, the things we're accustomed to, it depends on people, you know, using their fingers and dragging things with the fingers and, you know, create all these hand gestures and stuff.
Right.
And it only stood the reason this thing's much bigger. It's that you hold it in a completely different way. It has room for two hands instead of one that, you know, would be able to do all these other things. But no, it's basically just a big iPhone. And, however, you know, in terms of the barriers, it's pure Apple. And, of course, we wouldn't expect anything different, but...
what do you mean by the barrier?
Closed. Everything that could possibly, you know, they have this channel called called iTunes, right? Or
yes.
The iTunes Music Store, whatever you want to call it. And it makes huge amounts of money, and it's a throttle on the music industry, and they're trying to make it into a throttle on the movie and TV industry. And now, of course, they're moving into the area, you know, that we consider kind of sacred in terms of print media and, you know, written media. And they don't want to give up anything there. And if it has more fidelity than a web page, you're not going to be able to get it onto this device except through the store. Now, they've made some promises about, you know, HTML5 will be able to do more and whatnot, but that's still a promise. And they've turned off Flash and they've turned off Java. And that was true also of the iPhone, but now it becomes a big sort of issue here, you know, because this is, I guess, presented to be more of a computing device. Maybe it's not. I mean, you know.
So it's sort of an attack on gatelessness.
On what?
Gatelessness.
Right, it's a big honking gate, and it's Steve's and all Steve's, you know, And it's got this weird characteristic that I think the media industry will both feel extremely, they'll feel extremely comfortable with this, okay, and they shouldn't, because he's creating this environment where they're completely controlled by him, and because it appeals to their greed. It also completely controls the customer. And,
right.
Yeah.
This,
and
this
so
is the part
it,
that, just to interrupt you for a second, this is the thing that really struck me about it when I started to understand what it was. Of course, I haven't used it or operated it.
No, none of us.
I'm relying on, you know, short, fragmentary reports from people
right.
who got a few minutes with it. It's like an audience with the Pope, you know.
Yeah.
A few minutes
and
with
they
the
chose
iPad.
their acolytes very carefully.
Yeah, obviously. But what struck me about it, and a lot of people have argued with me, but I still think it's a valid point, that the device seems to be moving backward in web time towards the read-only web from
mm-hmm.
the read-write web. And as David Carr said today or yesterday in his column, it's not a device for creating content. It's a device for consuming media.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the thing that really interests me, because they're clearly making a product for people who just want to consume. And while there are a lot of people in that situation,
yeah.
it's still kind of a shift backward in web time.
But, Jay, the Mac is also a product for people who just want to consume. Even though you can create with it, the preponderance of use of the platform is for you know, I don't like the word consume, but for reading, you know, the input side as opposed to the output side. But, you know, up until this point, there was always an assumption that computers had an obligation to also allow people to create on them so that you would find this sort of serendipity where, you know, a talented beginner would just find that their computer was tinkerable, that they could just open up the lid and start playing with it, and then all of a sudden their talent would develop. And, you know, this is where a lot of the innovation in computers have come from. It's,
right.
You know, it's from people just, you know, it goes all the way back to the Apple II and before that, actually, too. But the Apple II was sort of the watershed of this. And you had all kinds of people that, you know, because it was a $2,000, you know, computer, it was affordable. And it showed up, I mean, it doesn't seem affordable, by the way, by today's standards. But in those days, computers cost $30,000 or $50,000, right? So you take the same thing that you could buy for that kind of money and turn it, you know, now you can buy it for $2,000. All of a sudden, you know, it started, people would buy them for their kids, and those kids grew up and became programmers. And, you know, the concern here is, it's sort of like, I always lobbied for podcasting, that it was important that podcast devices also be able to record. This is one of my three requirements for them. And because even though most people wouldn't create podcasts, you never know, right?
Right.
Who's going to do it and when they're going to do it. And you might as well put the hardware there so that when that happens, you know, this all is totally consistent with our developing philosophy of the rebooted news system, right? You
right.
want to have it in the hands of everybody. And
also, anyone,
we're going to be, sorry.
Anyone can doesn't mean everyone will.
Right, that's
but
right.
But it's still very important.
Absolutely, and clearly Apple has never shared that philosophy, or Steve Jobs has never shared that philosophy. This has sort of been the duality of Apple. There's Jobs and there's Woz, and Woz was sort of the character of, you know, the you know, he's more like we are in that.
The tinkerer.
Yeah, and the enabler and the truster. He trusts people, right? Whereas Jobs says, you know, it's my art. You know, Doc Searls wrote a wonderful essay about this in 1997. Where he said basically our job is to appreciate his art as opposed to, you know,
right.
creating anything on our own. And this is a refinement of that to the nth degree. I mean,
the auteur theory of technology, in an essay in the New York Times, that's how
mm-hmm.
they put it. You know, the great artists release his creation, and it's our job to appreciate it.
Yes, up to a point. I mean, at a certain point, the art of the universe is more interesting and more important. You know, and our collective art is by far more important than the art of Steve Jobs.
Now, let me ask you something.
Yeah.
Understanding that Apple wants this throttle, that it released a device that is kind of a closed system, that it's very difficult to plug anything into it, and it's made for consuming, mm-hmm. not for creating media. What are the ways that it could turn around? Well, is it possible that users could open it up anyway? I mean, what are some of the vulnerabilities, if you will, that could yet turn it into a read-write device, despite the fact that it's not necessarily made for that?
I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, it didn't happen with the iPhone. Sure, people jailbroke their iPhone, which meant basically they cracked in behind all the protections and were able to get to the core, you know, system and do have their way basically with their own hardware. But a very, very small number of people did that. And I don't expect that's going to be the way they get routed around. I think that what happens here is they created a perfect competitor, perfect space for a competitor that zigs to their zag. You know, everything that they aren't and nothing that they are. So, you know, a Google, I have this sneaking suspicion, and it's just that, a suspicion that they rushed this out, that, you know, the story was not complete. And, you know, he did this town hall meeting at Apple for employees right after he did the rollout, and it leaked. And in that rollout was a lot of bluster at all of his competitors. And in doing that, I think that I have this feeling that, so, well, first of all, I think that Google may well have their own, you know, tablet computer ready to go or almost ready to go. I think they have to have that. I mean, and I think that Apple knew that they had it, and that's why this was rushed out. I also think that there's an awful lot of play acting going on here as well. I'm trying to think of an example. It's like professional wrestling, you know, before they have a match, one guy
yeah.
growls at the other guy, and the other guy yells about the other guy's mother or whatever, and, you know, behind the stage, they're really friends. You know, they go out for drinks, and their wives,
right.
you know, whatever. And I think there's a lot of that going on here. I think if you look at how clever this is, actually, they've marginalized Microsoft. I mean, Google and Apple decided to split the market. They said, well, it's better if we split the market between us, you know, in every regard, every tech market. We split it, and we leave Microsoft out of it. Nobody's talking about Microsoft, Jay. And, you know,
that's
no accident. That happens to be what both Google and Apple want desperately, is Microsoft to be marginalized. They are a big player here. They've got a lot of users, and nobody's talking about them. And so I think you can see that there is the, this is a long-winded, very long-winded answer to your question, but there has got to be a Google Pad out there, and it's going to be everything that Apple's isn't and nothing that it is. It's going to be wide open. It's going to take any software you want to put on it. It's going to have lots of ports, and it'll run Flash, you know, and Java, and anything else you want to put on it. And it won't
Meanwhile.
Be as sweet as Apple's, but it will do everything you want it to do. It won't have those
mm-hmm.
limits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It won't have
it'll
the
be...
same elegance and
no.
perfection of design.
No, it won't. But you'll be able to do stuff with it. Now, that'll be the one I will use. I've already made the switch. I don't expect to turn back. Although I do expect I will buy an iPad because
yeah.
I can't be left out of that. I have to know about it, you know.
Meanwhile, big media companies seem to see the iPad as a chance for them to get their mojo back because it is a content consumption device.
Well, what do you see there?
So they're thinking. We have the content. Here's the device.
Right.
Well, I think they're engaging in wish fulfillment. I think the best way to understand their enthusiasm would actually be almost a psychoanalysis of the industry in which the iPad promises a kind of magical deliverance from the problem of how to create value in a world of many producers. Because if it is a content consumption machine and that will be paid stuff coming through the gate, as you said, then those who can afford magnificent productions, just like in Hollywood, those who can afford the big budget to create the thriller or the big budget disaster movie or the action adventure film, which takes hundreds of millions of dollars, those producers have the advantage. So I think there's an attraction to the device that's almost akin to a kind of deliverance. It's magical thinking that this is going to restore the age of big media. That would be the thing I would be worried about if I were a media CEO, that this device will help make my people into deniers of the changed world that they're living
well,
in.
Well, there sure is tons of that. I mean,
So that's sort of what.
Yeah, Howard Weaver showed up in the discussion under one of my pieces on this subject, and basically said I was a subscriber to the Open Religion, and they would be he sort of spoke on behalf of users, saying we are very happy to get into. I think of it as like a locked trunk. It could be very nice. It might be very warm and comfortable and whatever, but it is locked. So I will be happy to get in there, and you idealists. Did you remember you called me an idealist? On our show? And what's so bad about that? it's almost a pejorative term, it seems, but to be called, being described as what we're doing, Open Religion, I feel like, we're fighting for him. Although, at the same time, I think Apple is fighting for him, too. I had spent a fair amount of time trying to help my mom, who just got a new Asus. I bought her an Asus netbook computer for pictures, because she's taking pictures all over the place, and I want her to get them on the web, and it is so difficult.
Yeah.
So many steps, so many layers. It's just like when you see a computer through the eyes of somebody who's sort of coming into it from with none of the preparation, and you can then you can see how awful the computer really is,
Yeah.
And it does need a fresh start, but I just would like the fresh start not to be a prison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, whenever a journalist calls me an idealist, I know that it's an ideological act they're undertaking there, in which they're claiming the ground of realism for themselves.
Right, right.
And they're saying, well, you have some valid points, but you don't really live in the real world. Whereas, from my point of view, the shift in power that has made the former audience into producers as well as consumers, that's not an idealistic thing. That's a fact of life.
Yeah.
That is realism.
Right.
And what happens is that people try to frame you as a dreamer or utopian because you are stating as a realistic fact something that happens to be new and unsettling and transformative and disruptive.
Right. And
so
the
that's
iPhone,
what's going on.
The iPad it meets the old media's needs from another standpoint because it recasts the user as a consumer again.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. I mean, they can't run
that's,
on.
That's
just
the
what you're saying, right?
Excitement about it, yeah.
Well, it's not just that they love it because their content can be now sold on it. They might have a revenue model here, which I think they probably do actually have a revenue model here. So
yeah, they probably do, yeah.
Unrealistic. But the fact that it is crippled and keeps the user in that little box is sort of like maybe the real payoff.
It's
simply creating trouble.
It's undoing my 2006 post, The People Formerly Known as the Audience. It's putting you back in the seats.
Right, right. I want to come back to that because there's the next thing I think I'd like to talk about is this outstanding event where President Obama went in front of the Republicans. David Weinberg, I thought, had the best comment about it. I watched it, and I was transfixed. Like everybody, I think, who watched it was. It's really interesting because I found that Obama was saying the kind of things we say behind their backs. You know, that that this is that what they talk about is nonsense. And he was kind of saying that to the Republicans. It's, oddly, he doesn't say it to the press that much. But, you know, so, you know, Weinberger's observation, David Weinberger's observation, was that that the Republicans did a better job of grilling Obama than the press does. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder what is really, and he's, he, I don't know, he's half right, because I think Obama did a better job of answering.
Right.
You know,
well, that's in many ways a better system. In the UK system, they have question time with the Prime Minister, which is has the same institutional place that the primetime press conference has in the U.S. And it's not a perfect institution. There's a lot of grandstanding. There's a lot of kind of fake questions and phony answers as well. But the idea that one party questions the other removes from the equation a tribe of professional journalists who have an interest in retaining their place in the political culture from administration to administration.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the reason why it seems like fresher and crisper and
so do you think that eventually gets stale, Jay? Do you think that if we were to restructure our system so that that were a regular event, do you think it would get stale?
Well, as I said, I think once it becomes ritualized, it does lead to grandstanding. There's lots of ways of phonying it up. It's not in any way a perfect solution. But we don't have enough direct confrontation between responsible office holders. And I do think that the Washington Press, in its elite version, the Church of the Savvy, as I call them, is a failed institution at this point. I have no trouble saying that. It is a failed institution. It doesn't work. And what's remarkable to me is how this institution can observe that more and more of the country is saying Washington doesn't work without including itself. I just heard David Gregory say this week on Meet the Press. Another thing happened this week within this world is Candy Crowley of CNN got a show on Sunday morning as John King moved up to get a weeknight show, so there was a place open. And so she's the first woman to have one of these Sunday shows of her own, right? So there's a spate of press coverage about this event, which I looked at carefully. One of the things that struck me about it was that celebrating the first woman, Candy Crowley finally gets her own show, a couple of gushing interviews with her about how excited she is to get her own show. None of the journalists even ask her, and she doesn't even think to discuss, well, what are your ideas for the show? How are you going to revive it? How are you going to improve this tired format, which is completely broken down, just as the Church of the Savvy and the Washington Culture have broken down? It's like it's not even in the discussion that you would have an idea. You just have a show, and the show goes on, and it's like every other show, and I'm a tough interviewer, and I think I'm fair, and I'll ask everybody the tough questions, and my God, it's almost like a brain-dead form.
But at the same time, I caught a little bit of it because I was flying back, and so the Sunday morning shows were on while I was sitting in the airport at Kennedy, and they had CNN, so she actually caught the announcement. And right after that, Howard Kurtz came on. And,
yes.
So this is like the extent of my Sunday morning TV watching for like the last year. I really haven't been watching it at all. And what I did catch, Joan Walsh was on, and
yes,
a few others from and whatever, and they were talking about Obama in front of the Republicans, and they all seemed to like it a lot, even though it seems every bit as threatening as to their existence or authority or, you know, as anything a user might do. This is users, basically.
Mm.
I mean, is this sources go direct or, you know, what?
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
Yeah, and in, it's also what Weinberg. Let's go into the Mark Coddington piece now, where he has the quotes. There's like eight sound bites from media elite or whatever we're called.
A quick guide to the maxims of new media, yeah.
Right.
Which are basic to the rebooted system of news. And in fact, they are all kind of building blocks of the new system of news.
Perhaps. I might not agree with one or two of them, actually, but the one here that will apply, and Weinberger did this quite well in relating this in his blog post, was transparency is the new objectivity. He says,
right.
Well, the Republicans did a good job of grilling the president because there was no pretense of objectivity. We know
right.
who they are. We know where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. And they're not trying to be objective. They're trying to rake him over the coals. They're trying to mm-hmm. embarrass him. They're trying to come up with good fodder for political ads, right? And
right.
they're trying to nail this guy, you know. Nothing wrong with that, right?
No, there isn't. And in a way, it's more refreshing because we don't have to suffer the pretense of the professional interrogator who has no stake but knows how to ask the tough questions.
Yeah.
Instead, it's two people it's two sides with big stakes going after each other, which is
right.
in a way more refreshing. Yeah.
David Gregory is sort of the ultimate in, you know, take out every element, every bit of humanity out of, you know, completely go bloodless out of, you know. So here, let's go through these. Do what you do the best and link to the rest. Hard to argue with that, right? That's
a very important principle from Jeff Jarvis.
This one I do argue with. If the news is important, it will find me. And that one, they didn't really have a source for. I got to say, I've never liked that one, and I found a reason specifically why I don't like it this last week. I was emailing with a number of different people because it's as you well know, I am now a visiting scholar at NYU, and I'm becoming at least half-time New Yorker. Well, some very close friends of mine didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know it, even though I had blogged it and tweeted it extensively. And I think it's because we are basically getting pretty lax about creating systems where the news that we depend on or that we need to know actually does make it to us. And so I find that one to be, I don't think that's futuristic.
All right. But let's underline what it's supposed to be saying. If the news is important, it will find me. The notion there is that the flow of news constantly in and around us is by now good enough that most of the items that we really want to know about will be surfaced, if not in this forum, in that one, or
right, but
not at this opportunity, then the next.
I don't think that's true. I think
okay.
that you miss a lot if you do that. You do. There are. I of course agree with that in a very large sense because I've been the promoter of the River of News concept, right?
Yes.
Which was the opposite for years. The tech industry did not subscribe to that. They felt, well, what we need to do that news is like email, and I need to read every piece of news that comes to me, and that becomes unworkable very quickly, and you know they didn't know how to deal with the unworkability of it. And the way to deal with it is okay, you know, I'm going to relax about it and not make sure. But there is some truth to it, that there is a certain kind of news that you want to make sure you don't miss.
Right.
You know, I give you an example. There was a bug in my RSS reader, or a bug in RSS, actually. I have this blog today, or whatever, how you ever characterize it, I wasn't seeing my mother's blog posts in my RSS. And so that's a bug, right, Jay?
That's certainly a bug, yeah.
Yes.
That's a cockroach.
you go to hell for that. So, you know, there are certain feeds that you do want to be...
Yeah,
all right. I think
right.
I made my point on that one.
Well, an example of how it worked for me was... I'm very interested in this Google story and the attack from China. But I didn't exactly know, like, who are the best sources to follow on that. But I didn't need to spend a lot of time on it. I could have hunted down,
right.
like, who to follow. But I figured somebody will tell me or I'll somehow
I very specifically tweeted that exact piece of information.
Yeah, and I did. I found the guy
that...
And it worked. You know what I mean? It worked. It's a messy system, but it kind of worked. Anyway, that's what that means. Information wants to be free is one that I kind of have a irritant about because and I wrote a post about this actually, that phrase, information wants to be free, has become a battering ram for people who want to restore paid content.
Right.
And they claim that there are all these people running around with this ideology, but they fail ever to cite any. And, of course, the original quote didn't really say that. It said information wants to be free, and sometimes it wants to be expensive as well. So that's just a big ideological free-for-all, that statement.
Right.
And
it is. It's a mess. And,
it's a mess.
It doesn't say that
mess.
Your writing wants to be free. It says that the information wants to be free, and that's a big difference.
Yeah, you know, it's almost like water wants to flow freely, right?
Yeah.
It's like that. It's more like that than information wants to be without any price to it. It's not, no such thing as information overload. There's only filter failure, I think, is a great concept from Clay Shirky, which was recently expanded upon by David Weinberger. We like this because it doesn't seek to control the endless expansion of information available as more and more producers come online and more consumers turn into producers. Instead, we have to improve the systems for finding the good stuff.
Yeah, no dispute there.
Readers know more than I do. I think we both believe in that.
Yes, but I have a problem with it. It betrays a point of view, and it still is a long tail type thing, and I don't like the long tail because who's at the head, you know? Because it's saying basically, I still see myself at the top of the pyramid, and you know, and I think that there's probably another way to say it. I'm going to work on it.
I don't see it that way at all. I don't get how do you get that? My readers know more than I do. Puts me at the top of the pyramid. How's that?
Yeah. So let me work on that. All right,
let's come back
to that one. Okay.
Okay.
I remember very clearly saying this incorrectly, quoting Dan. Okay, this comes from Dan Gilmore, and getting raked over the coals because I said it a way that did not put him at the top of the pyramid, and I was told this is a very important part of it because we have to preserve our place there. I don't remember the whole thing, so I want to say let's come back to it. And let me just say the next one I completely endorse, I so much so that I think I invented it. But
well, the people probably know it in the audience?
That's yours, Jay, and God bless you. I think the highest praise ever is to say I invented it, not you, right? I have another one, by the way, because I'm next on this list. But I have another one that's only...
Right, you're the next on the list.
Yes, I know, but I
want to
put
directly
one in here, okay, that I think should be in here, which is only steal from the best.
Uh-huh.
I stole that from someone. I don't know who came up with that one, but it's a beautiful phrase because it says, I don't have any shame about stealing, but I also don't have any shame about telling you who I stole from. And,
right?
Because I want everybody to feel like they got the recognition that they were looking for, and I am proud of the fact that I didn't reinvent this. And in technology, it's very important because it tends to build compatibility instead of incompatibility. So
another phrase of yours that should be on this list is people come back to places that send them away.
Yeah, I would have preferred if that. Well, I mean, I like sources go direct. That's really important. But yes, people return to places that send them away is a very, very important principle of the. Although that's kind of what Jarvis says, right? Jarvis says, you know, quote the rest.
Sort of, yeah.
It's very similar, actually. So,
yeah,
you know, we can say that base did kind of get covered. And then we all know, they say that basically if you listen to this podcast, you're going to hear about sources go direct ad nauseum until you can't hear it anymore. So, we'll skip over that one.
I want to go on to a news story that interests me quite a bit.
Yeah.
AOL, which is moving into journalism in a big way, they're placing a major bet on original content, and they're hiring journalists both full-time and freelance. And it's unclear yet if they're going to emerge as a quality producer or a sophisticated purveyor of crap, but we have our hopes, you know, and it's kind of an internal struggle within the company. But Saul Hansel, who quit the New York Times, where he'd been a technology writer for many years, contributing a lot to the Bits blog, took a job at AOL to run their online assignment system called Seed.com, which is their way of creating a sophisticated freelance network of people who can log into this system, get assignments, get instructions, return their copy, and get paid with a minimum of fuss and transaction costs. And in order to sort of test this system and kickstart it and get his people motivated to improve it, he came up with this idea for an experiment in which AOL is trying to produce features on all 2,000 bands performing at South by Southwest in March in Austin, Texas, and offering $50 to each contributor who would pick out a band they want to write about, research their history and sort of musicology and biography, and also grab an interview with the band at South by Southwest and produce a feature according to a set of instructions that they would also be able to get from this Seed.com system. And this is a perfect rebooting the news story for several reasons. First is, we sort of talked about this idea maybe about 20 shows ago. We talked about how to do complete coverage, let's say, of the Boston mayoral race, where you first try to imagine what would it look like if we had 100% coverage, right? And you program that in to an open source assignment system, and then you try and get as close as you can. Well, this is sort of what Saul's doing. He's saying, what would 100% coverage of the bands performing at South by Southwest look like? And he's trying to get them all, and pay for them, and he will get them all. And then his idea is that, well, there'll be a bunch of uses of these pieces because they're kind of like little reference pieces about each band, right? So there'll be different ways in which AOL could use them as each of these bands makes news in their pop culture coverage. They can use these features as kind of instant backgrounders on the bands. And it gets him into the testing phase of this project. So I'm very interested in this because I want to create for Studio 20 or adapt from someone else's tools an open source assignment desk system like this. Where not only can anybody get their assignments, that's what Saul wants, but also anyone can insert assignments into it. You know what I mean?
Like,
you have something we should assign, put it here. It goes into the assignment desk. People come, they get it, they complete the work, they bring it back. And I just wanted to throw that out and get your...
Let me
view
come back
of like what are the challenges there.
Yeah,
maybe
no,
we can talk about it in future shows.
Well, let me say a little bit about it right now. I think first of all, I think it's brilliant. I think I had not heard about it before the show, so you're getting my instant reaction. But I think it's brilliant because South by Southwest is both a music and a blogging show, so it's going to have all the right people there. It's not like
I'm going to be there.
Well, good. I'm glad. I won't. We have a long history. I've never been to South by Southwest. They won't invite me unless I apologize for doing something that I never did. So it's like it's crazy. But
go on.
That's another story. But they have the right people there, and the music, the independent music scene is already very networked, very web aware. They use the web very heavily. And the great thing about it is that it will create kind of a Wikipedia for the independent music scene that is complete. And it won't just stop because this was another attribute of the system we talked about, right?
Right.
It doesn't stop when the event is over. It continues. In a way, this becomes the coral reef for a rebooted news system around the music industry. What they have put potentially created here is something that only they could do in this context at this
right.
moment. Saul is brilliant. I mean, it's an absolutely fantastic idea. And you're brilliant because it also applies to what NYU is doing, and it's actually an item on my list to talk about on the show, is that I think that we ought to teach community members to blog in the NYU area. I think we ought to have a regular thing where maybe once a week, and I think the students ought to do it, Jay. I think this is, for them, potentially an incredible learning experience.
Well, this is why I'm so excited about the assignment desk system, because the part that really interested me the most in Saul's experiment is that if you log in and you pick up a band to cover, right, you get a set of instructions for what your post should look like. And if you sort of click on that,
Have you seen those instructions?
I haven't seen them, no. But that's where you get a great potential, because if we can improve those instructions, then it becomes an educational tool in addition to a way of distributing work, and we empower more people to become contributors while we're also getting our work done.
It's a template. You know, all these things, goes back to only steal from the best. We hope that they're open to that, but then we make contributions to the, you know, structure of it, and everybody wins. I just think it's a wonderful thing that they're doing.
I put out a little notice on Twitter last night saying, does anyone know about a working open source assignment desk system? You know, I'd just like to see models and prototypes, and maybe there is one that I don't know of. And I got quite a few replies back.
Tell us what an assignment desk looks like. I mean,
well, I'm going to write a
post. I doubt if very many programmers have a clue what an assignment desk does.
Yeah.
I would be surprised if the answer comes back yes. However, this is the convergence that we're trying to create, right?
Maybe it's something you want to work on.
Of course. It's something I want to work on. Absolutely. No question about it.
I think it's super
cool.
If
I don't want to work on it, I would be happy to work with the people who do want to work on it. So. Yeah.
All right. Well, at Studio 20, we're going to put some effort into this, and other people are too. It's not just an interest of mine. A lot of people are actually onto this right now.
Right. Well, hopefully that we can all work together and share what we learn. I mean, right? That's
the idea.
That goes back to all the way to the beginning of this episode, right? We're talking about the difference between the Apple way of doing things and the way we want to do it. Apple would let us all wait until they figure out how to let us do a small piece of this problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what we want to do is we want to do the whole problem before we're even close to ready to do a small piece of it.
Right.
And learn from that experience and then come back and do it better next time. That's,
of course.
That's my approach to these things. So, you know, go for broke. Fall down on your face, but get a little bit done, get inspiration, show people, everybody else, what you're thinking, so that then they can steal from the best.
Right.
In other words, they can steal from you.
Right.
Right.
Of course, our way of doing it is very messy, and Steve's is nice and elegant.
Welcome to the human race, though. I mean, that's the whole nature of what we are. We are messy. If you think it's neat, that's the thing is, if you go to Steve Jobs' house, I read this profile of him and somewhere in this whole press thing. They went to his house, and they said, there's hardly any furniture in this guy's house. But the furniture that he has is impeccable, and he can tell you exactly why it's so great, which you gotta love. I mean, he's complete. He's consistent, and he's perfect, you know?
He's one of the great modernists ever.
He just happens to be a jerk. Excuse me.
Come on.
No, he's brilliant. I love him. I'm looking at a Mac right now. But, you know, anyway.
All right. I think we've got this one in the can, Dave.
Well, we unfortunately still have 60 seconds to fill.
Well,
how's the weather?
I'm looking forward in future shows to discussing projects you are undertaking with Studio 20 as we recruit journalists who speak geek and geeks who speak journalism and put them to work on really cool projects. That's our approach.
Yep. I just want to say that this morning, I had this realization that for the first time, I'm no longer tentative about being in New York.
Great.
I mean, yeah, every step along the way, it was, if I can do this, if I can do this, if I can do this, I will then be in New York. But the things that I have left to do are, I have to get on an airplane. That's when we get there.
Yeah.
That's it. When I get there, apartment waiting for me and a good, great work environment, I think, and lots of fun. So.
No one should move to New York who is not willing to be lucky. E.B. White said that.
Okay. That, on that note, thank you very much, and great RBTN.
See you next week, Dave. Bye.
Bye. Mm-hmm.